Morning, Counsel. Thank you for your supplemental briefs. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes. May I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Johnny Kanaga, Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of Defendant Appellant Christopher Ramos. Your Honor, in this case, the ICA, in its supplemental order, in its order rescinding the previous order, asked the parties to address three questions. One was the impact of Nesmith, Gonzalez, and Apollonio on this case. And those cases, collectively, I believe the court was referring to the Nesmith type of issue raised in those cases in terms of the charge. They also had some bearing toward the foundation for the laser gun reading as well. But basically what Nesmith, Gonzalez, and Apollonio hold is that even under the more liberal construction standard applied where the charge is challenged for the first time on appeal, the charge that is missing a state of mind is deficient, and the conventional remedy would be vacate and for dismissal without prejudice. Now, the second question kind of ties into the first question. The court asked whether Ramos had made a deliberate choice not to raise the Nesmith issue. And as I stated in my supplemental brief, that was not a deliberate choice, it was inadvertent. Now, prior to Davis.
I guess kind of Davis kind of makes that the question we asked the first time around moot, because under Davis, I guess you don't have to make a choice. You can, I guess, maybe I should ask you. So you can raise that issue at any time, even if you forgot to raise it before.
Correct. Because under Apollonio, the charge of the Nesmith issue is raised for the first time on appeal. Now, Apollonio came up, the briefing was done prior to Nesmith. So in a footnote in that case, the Supreme Court noted that the parties couldn't have raised the issue via Nesmith because it had not been previously ruled upon. However, in Armitage, which was not an excessive speeding case, but which was cited in the briefs, that case actually, the Nesmith issue was not raised at trial or on appeal, and it was raised for the first time actually by the Supreme Court when they asked for supplemental briefing on the issue. So sua sponte, the court raised it. So it appears clear that even though the issue was not raised in the opening brief here, and this court can rule on that issue and should rule on that issue.
Yeah. Okay, so the bottom line is you are asserting that you are asserting the deficiency in the charge based on mens rea for this appeal.
Yes.
Before us.
Yes. I believe that it's pretty clear, and the state has also agreed with that the charge is deficient for failure to charge the state of mind. If I may move on, whether the third issue is, I guess, the more complicated one, is whether the manufacturer of the laser gun has set forth specific training requirements for the operation of the laser gun. And I believe, Chief Judge, you raised that in your dissenting opinion. And it was also raised in the concurring opinion in Amaral by Chief Justice Rechtingwall and Justice Nakayama. So my short answer to that would be, in this case, there was no record, there was no evidence of what was contained in the manual. The manual was subject to a motion to compel. It's unclear from the record whether the defense actually made a copy of the manual. However, the manual was never entered into evidence. There was reference to the manual at some point during testimony, and it was on cross-examination where defense counsel had asked.
Does the record indicate whether the defense counsel received the manual in discovery?
In reviewing the district court record, the electronic record of the proceedings, which I believe is part of the record before this court, there was a motion to compel file that was granted. The court granted it and said that the defense counsel could make one copy of the manual, not for dissemination. Subsequent court date, defense counsel indicated that it had not made a copy of the manual and asked for a continuance, which was then charged to the defense. The trial date after that the court date after that was trial. So it's not clear whether defense counsel had actually made a copy or not. I believe there's some.
But is the implication from those events that the defense counsel subsequently obtained the manual before trial?
It seems reasonable to assume so, because defense counsel referred to material in the manual during cross-examination. The standard order doesn't allow dissemination, so theoretically we couldn't have gotten that from another case. We have to have gotten it from this case.
And is the record in this case indicate what the manual is? Because in Amaral, I guess the court referred to, I guess there's a training manual, there's a manufacturer's manual, there's an operating manual. I guess there's several different things of what the manual could mean. Is there any clarification in this case what the manual requested was?
There are actually four manuals. Now, in this case, we actually did not ask for the four separate ones, but conventionally, in Amaral, those other cases, we've asked for four separate manuals. So it would be the instructor manual, the training manual, and the specific operator manuals that we've applied to each of the specific devices, the Marksman and the Ultralight. Those manuals, those the operator's manual appear to be the type of manual, for instance, that you get with a microwave oven or a refrigerator, basically going over the operations, telling how to operate. The training manuals, the instructor manual and the training manual, it's unclear, and the it's not part of the record in this case, again, as to what is specifically contained in it. Now, throughout cross-examination, throughout direct examination, when the state was trying to lay the foundation, the state used interchangeably the terms manufacturer's manual, manufacturer's training manual. At one point, the state asked the officer a question about the manual, and he says, you know, are you talking about the operator's manual? I don't understand.
But what manual does the record reflect that the state request, that the defense requested in discovery and inferentially received since their motion to compel was granted?
It appears to refer to the operator's manual because at that point this was, you know, quite a while back. So I believe there wasn't as much specificity as the type of manuals. We weren't aware of the different types of manuals. So there's only one manual requested, but it doesn't refer to it in terms used in Amaral, such as, you know, training manual, operator's manual. So it's unclear specific, but I believe back then we were getting the operator's manual. And it appears that that's what defense counsel was referring to on cross-examination.
Okay, so your answer to the last question we pose is you can't answer it because there's not enough information in the record to provide an answer.
Correct. It appears, however, though, I mean, if we go by inference, that there are specific manufacturer's requirements. You know, I would note that back in Asai was when the courts first started mentioning manufacturers' recommendations as to training and operation. And at that point, from that point on, the state has never objected and said these requirements don't exist, so we can't fulfill them. In fact, when you read the cases, the state continues to try and lay a foundation that the officer's training is consistent with the manual. So it appears that there are some training requirements in the manual. They also speak of the officers being qualified or certified, which would imply that there is some sort of process that the state at least believes is used.
Well, maybe the state's asking those questions in response to SIA, so they're figuring, well, the court must think there's something in there, so maybe we got to ask those questions.
It's possible, but at some point the state has the burden of proving that either there are these recommendations and that we are going to fulfill them, or that there aren't these recommendations.
Okay, so your bottom line, though, is that we don't know one way or the other whether, in fact, there are specific recommendations by the manufacturer regarding training concerning the operation of the laser gun.
Not on the record before this court.
Okay.
Before you get too far afield, Mr. Kinoga, when referring to the manuals here, there was training as to the marksman initially, and then 4 years later, I think it was referred to as like a familiarization course for 1 hour on the ultralight when it came out. So in this record and the discovery, was it as to both types of the laser gun when referring to the manual?
Again, it's unclear from the record because it was never entered into evidence and referred to. The order granting the motion to compel speaks only of one, it says a manual, it's ordered, is allowed to make one copy of the manual. So. But it doesn't specify.
And the request itself didn't specify
no.
Which type of laser gun. Because here the ultralight was used, right?
The ultralight was used in this case.
And the other question that I have in light of your discussion so far is the requirement not to disseminate the manual. What is the underlying concern here? I mean, I think that there's some suggestions here and there in various cases, but I'd like to understand a little bit better what the concern has been with disseminating the manual. From your perspective?
Well, my understanding is that, in the beginning, when these cases first began, the state wasn't going to turn over any type of manual, whether it was the operator's manual or training manual. And my understanding back then was that there was some concern about LTI's permission to disclose that because LTI has a copyright on them, and also the HPD training manuals, which are also referred to at times, maybe they thought it was some sort of internal information that shouldn't be disseminated. So subsequent, after we had filed a number of motions to compel, then the courts began granting it, subject to a protective order. In this case, for example, the court ordered the defense to prepare a protective order, and it appears that no protective order was prepared, which in part was, may have led to the problem with getting the manual. But the protective order allows us generally to make one copy of the manual, to review it and to make one copy and not to disseminate it, so it can't be used in other cases. So each particular case, we would have to do a separate motion to compel.
But you can use it in cross-examination, though.
Correct.
I'm sorry.
No, read my mind.
Let me ask you this question, kind of going back to the first series of issues that were raised. After State v. Davis, is a defect in a charge jurisdictional anymore?
It would appear that, based on what the ruling was in Davis, that the court just broadly states that the charge that fails to state a state line is fatally defective, regardless of whether it's a jurisdictional defect, because if it's a jurisdictional defect, then it would be, the problem would arise that then the trial itself would be moot, so the sufficiency issue would probably not be as relevant. So it appears that the court has just made a blanket ruling that such a defective charge violates due process, and it cannot be construed to charge an offense. That's the language in there. So it.
Could the court do what it did if a defect in the charge was jurisdictional?
Generally not, because I think prior to this, and based on the rulings of the court, which was when we raised the Nesmith issue, and I believe that was the ICA's position as well, that once the Nesmith issue was raised, it appeared to be a jurisdictional type of issue, so there was no necessity to rule on issues such as sufficiency. But it appears that now the Supreme Court has clarified via Davis that the court, for whatever particular basis, it appears to just be grounded in due process, that the sufficiency issue must still be ruled upon. So,
going forward, you're reading Davis, which I think is the last announcement of the Supreme Court on the issue, that the charging defect is no longer jurisdictional, and we're looking at purely on due process grounds.
It appears so from the language in Davis. That's my reading.
Right.
Under Davis, the Supreme Court references that sufficiency of the evidence should be addressed when it is expressly raised, as opposed to, I suppose, what happened in Gonzalez and Apollonio. Was sufficiency of the evidence expressly raised in this case?
Yes, it was not raised as a wholly separate issue. However, the concluding paragraph of the foundation, the foundational issue, stated that because there was not sufficient foundation for the speed reading, and that was the only evidence of the defendant's speed, that there was no sufficient evidence to sustain his conviction.
In the point of error?
Correct.
Okay, I'm also interested in how you're reading Amaral, which is, I think, the last Supreme Court decision on the foundation for the laser gun. Now, under Amaral, is the only way that you can lay a foundation for the operator's qualification based upon the manufacturer's recommendations? Or are there other ways of establishing that the police officer was qualified to operate the device?
I believe that Amaral is based on the presumption that there are such requirements, and it appears that there are such requirements, recommendations, manufacturer's recommendations. So based on Amaral's holding, I would say that yes, that right now, unless and until somebody establishes that there are no such recommendations, but it appears that there are, the only way to fulfill the requirement would be to prove what the recommendations are and improve compliance with those recommendations.
Well, why does that make any sense? Why is that the only way to establish that someone is qualified to operate the device?
If you look back at EID, EID was cited by, I believe, in some of the cases, and that involved, a device that had no manufacturer's recommendations. The device in that case, which was the dynamometer, was kind of a conglomeration of pieces. It It wasn't manufactured by a single manufacturer. There were three separate manufacturers for the three pieces. So in that type of case, the court said, well, okay, look, there's no manufacturer's recommendations, but there has to be a way to prove that this device works properly. So the court said, well, you can look at this operator was a mechanic, it was a simple mechanical device. And they also independently verified the speed via other means, such as, I think it was a speed gun type of thing, and also a device that's hooked up to the cart.
But why should that be the only way? Isn't the foundation is that the device is in good working order and the person who uses the device is qualified by experience and training to operate? Isn't that Tylo, the case that precedes all of these cases that has never been overruled?
Yes, but to the degree that I think the court has continued to clarify the requirements, the last clear word on it is that they must show compliance with the manufacturer's recommendations. I know that Chief Judge, you suggested other means, and that they were also suggested in the concurring opinion in Amaral as well. But if you read the black letter law of Amaral right now, it says that they still must prove the manufacturer's recommendations. So our position would be that
Well, what if there is no manufacturer's recommendation?
You could never
prove foundation, or then you default to the more broad standard that as long as you can show that they're competent to operate the device, then the training aspect of the foundation is satisfied.
I would guess that at that point then the court would have to re-examine what type of foundation was necessary. It would probably be somewhere along the lines of what you suggested, where they're showing that there's this means of operating the gun and the operator's competent at operating and pursuing through those things, and that he's able to come up with accurate speed readings. For example, again, back to you, there was independent verification for the readings on the dynamometer. So there was an independent verification. Now, in these excessive speeding cases, the officers can talk about training and this and that, but they never show that, okay, based on my training, I went out there and I laser gunned a bunch of cars, and they had independent verification of the speed of these cars, and it corresponded with what my readings were on the gun, so that shows that I'm able to do it properly.
But you think that if they were able to do that, that would qualify as sufficient to show they're qualified to operate the gun?
Well, it would be part of the foundation. I at this point,
Even though it's not, that's not recommended, even though the manufacturer doesn't have, to prove the person is qualified, he got to go out on the test track and laser gun a car 7 times and be right 6 out of 7 times.
Well, I think they refer to, there's a practical aspect of training, which would appear to refer to being able to not only operate the gun properly, but there may be some verification speed. Again, the problem is that the manufacturer's manual was never entered into evidence. In any of these cases, the state has failed to prove what these recommendations are, or even what the manual specifically says. They use these broad terms, consistent with the training of the manual, or it was along the lines of it corresponded to what was in the manual. But I believe that's a deficiency. Now, if somebody could get the manual in there and have a final word on it, then we could go and look into, if there's no manufacturer's recommendations in here, what would be sufficient foundation?
So your reading of Amaral is that unless the state proves that there is no manufacturer's recommendation, you need to show that the training complied with the manufacturer's recommendation before you can lay a foundation.
Again, I believe that the state's questions and throughout these cases, the state has never said, hey, you guys are holding us to an impossible standard because there are no recommendations. The state has never...
kind of seems like they take a long time to lay the foundation. Like this one is like 2 days to show that the person's qualified to use the device.
Yes, part of that was because of the number of objections that were raised. And if you look at it, actually the questions are pretty repetitive.
Do you know of any other jurisdiction that insists upon proof of training and compliance with manufacturer's recommendations to lay the foundation?
I can't answer that. I'm not familiar with other jurisdictions' requirements in terms of the laser gun.
Would the difficulty or simplicity in operating the device factor into our analysis on what is required to establish the person's qualification to operate the device? I'll give you an example. In this case, from reading the record, it seems to me that operating this laser gun is not rocket science. from the officer's standpoint, it's point the red dot at the center mass, pull the trigger. That's how you operate the device. If you operate it properly, the speed reading comes up. If you operate it improperly, there's a buzz that has an error message. So given that, I mean, what are we talking about in terms of having to train someone in a way that could give the court some feeling that they're sufficiently trained to operate the device?
Well, I believe there are factors that affect, and it is as simple just as pressing the button. However, you know, there are other factors that can affect the speed reading to a small degree, such as angle of which you're pointing the gun and things like that. When you're testing the gun, for example, you know, in terms of the distance, you have to be very specific where you're holding the distance. In fact, in this case, I don't know if the court saw it, but the officer actually calculated wrong. You know, he said that the reading was 28, so it meant that the distance, so that would correspond to a 14 mile per hour speed.
You mean the delta distance?
Yes, it actually would correspond to 56 mile per hour speed. So it's unclear whether this officer was even competent to make such calculations. Although when operating the gun would make those type of calculations. But if he's testing the gun and he can't even do the simple math which he wrote on his citation, you know, there seems to be a problem there. Again, also the fact that there are training manuals issued, and it's clear that there are these training manuals and operators' manuals, would imply that it's really not that simple to operate the gun, that there are other factors. You know, the training manuals are there's four separate ones to training, instructor training, you know, operator training. So it would imply that, you know, yeah, in basic terms, it is as simple as pointing the laser gun and pulling the trigger, but there may be other aspects. Again, the record before this court is not complete, so, you know.
Counsel, when you reference the four manuals, just to be clear for the record, are they all, in your mind, manufacturer manuals, or are they some of them HPD manuals?
In this case, the officer testified, it was unclear which manual he was referring to. In Amaral and I believe Gonzalez as well, they referred to manuals that have the LTI copyright, LTI seal. So those could be the operator's manuals. There also appears to be a training manual that's referenced in cases that has the HPD seal on it.
So when you reference four manuals standing here today, it could be HPD or it could be LTI.
Correct, and then there's some question whether the HPD, the HPD manual was sanctioned by LTI.
And you know, just one other thing in terms of, you mentioned that, you know, cross-examination in this case or the examination of the officer, I mean, took 2 days, and in part it was because of the number of objections, and it was just incredible, the number of objections in this case. I mean, how difficult is it, given the standard, to lay a foundation?
Well, I think one of the things that needs to be taken into consideration is that this is an older case. You know, I think this was 2010. So, you know, subsequently now, there's been a number of cases that have come out that have clarified what's required for foundation. So, and clarified what is admissible, what is hearsay in terms of reference to the manual. So I believe that it would be much cleaner now for given the new developments, such as Amaral and Gonzalez.
The two points that have been clarified.
Okay. We don't know yet, right? Because Amaral just came out.
Yes. I think I'm out of time. Thank you.
Right.
Don Fudo for the prosecution, so to say. Typically I speak, they tell me to speak rather fast. Today I'm going to read some things to slow it down. And also in response to the supplemental brief, I feel like first I need to get clarified my position with regard to the waiver issue. Because I'm thinking a waiver usually has to be knowingly and voluntarily made. And pursuant to my responsibilities as a minister of justice in Rule 3.8 of the Professional Rules of Conduct, I cannot in good conscience say that these were deliberate. It was a deliberate choice. Part of my belief is based upon the manner that this case was handled, in the sense that the Tachibana error, which is fatal and critical, it's never been brought before this court, so I have to bring the court's attention to the Tachibana error. The omission of the state of mind.
What was that? They didn't give him Tachibana, or they screwed it up?
Well, to paraphrase the judge, yeah, they screwed it up. I find that you're, this is what was told to Mr. Ramos. At this time, the defense would rest, Your Honor. That was the PD. Court, and Mr. Ramos, it's up to you. You cannot testify or put any witness on. Your attorney, who is very experienced, can give you advice, but it's your choice. Did you want to put on witnesses, or did you want to testify? Defendant, in all of it. The court, is anyone forcing you not to testify? Defendant, no. Okay, I find you intelligently and voluntarily waived. You're right. In light of Hahn, in light of Palmbury, nah, I'm not gonna.
All right, but is Tachibana waivable?
No. And the most recent one would be State versus Hanoi at 2014, Westlaw 535725. And it's basically because he didn't testify, and this was essentially a swearing match with only one person swearing. In that situation, the court says it's not harmless. So my feeling, again, as the Minister of Justice, I need to bring this to the court's attention, and it underlies the reason why I don't think the objection to the absence of the state of mind was deliberate. I appreciate what was written in the supplemental brief on page 2, footnote 2, as the inadvertent omission of it, and that they could have raised Nesmith, but you know, what makes me a little bit curious, Gonzalez didn't come out until after that they did the brief. So unless, and I have no reason to believe otherwise, but it wasn't in the record, unless they were intending for this case to have been the Gonzalez case, where it was definitively determined that excessive speed did have a state of mind, it just raises a question in my mind, what would you have been arguing with respect to Nesmith? So that's another reason I don't feel like it's a deliberate choice. For the sake of argument, I also believe that I would have a stronger feeling that these were deliberate choices if there had been some awareness of compliance with Rule 28J of the Hawaii Rules of Appellate Procedure, which basically states that when relevant cases come out after the briefing is concluded, you send a letter to the court. So when Gonzalez comes out, I send a letter to the court. All of a sudden, this expensive proceeding charge, we know it has a state of mind. Therefore, all these other cases now that came out subsequent to the briefing that deal with when the challenge can be raised, and which is basically now anytime, would also become germane had a Rule 28J letter been sent. With that being said, I move on to the next question.
Well, Mr. Fudo, before you leave the first question, and I understand your argument as to deliberate choice or not, but now that it has been raised, regardless of how it has been raised in this case, given the precedent, it's appropriate that we address that issue. Or do you disagree?
Definitely. Okay. And as clearly stated, it's not in the charge. I don't need to waste the court's time by reading the charge. It's just definitely not in there. People weren't aware of it.
Okay.
So as I move on now to the second question, which I'll generally say was the manufacturer's specific training requirements for the operation of the laser gun, I think what the court first needs to, what I would first like to expound on is, I don't believe.
Well, what's the answer to the question? Can you give me the answer?
Simple answer, qualified, absolutely no.
So there is no manufacturer's recommendation?
And I will discuss and explain that. And it starts, I think, with the answer to the question by defense counsel to me, which wasn't an answer. You weren't asking what we did in the briefing. You're asking, is there? So with that being said, I think it also becomes relevant to consider the objection at trial, which is, quote, we're renewing the defense's objection in terms of the officer's training. The defense counsel stated in relevant part, we don't believe there was evidence established by the officer, the ellipsis. There was no evidence what he was trained on in terms of the 4-hour course, a 1-hour course, 4-hour course in 94, 1-hour course in 1998. This, I believe, is a significant part. Met LTI, Laser Technology Instruments Institute's recommended procedures for training. I think in the same manner that Opilano says it's logical to presuppose that before the state can meet the requirement, they have to elicit evidence of LTI's requirements. To make this objection and be consistent with the rules of professional conduct, 3.1 and 3.0, I believe it is, just a moment. You'd have to have a legitimate basis to contend that such requirements exist. To just object without being able to say the requirements exist, I believe that's bad faith. And because I didn't hear an answer given by the defense counsel in this case as to your question about whether they exist, it causes me concern.
The state should know, right? I mean, you guys get the manuals. I mean, you folks should know one way or the other whether, in fact, the assumption the Supreme Court's making in these cases is accurate or not. If it's not accurate, doesn't the state have some obligation to tell someone at some point, either in a case before the Supreme Court or a trial, that, hey, this requirement that's been imposed upon us is not possible to be met?
Okay, I'll do that. I'll be that person. You can hold on just for one moment. I think what also underlies my notion that the objection may not well be well-founded is, contrary to what has been stated this morning, I don't believe Amaral left the state of the situation clear that such requirements exist. And I'll quote from Amaral on page 9 through 10. It's still on Westlaw, so that's the only citation I can give. But they quote, assuming that the manufacturer's recommendations were contained in the manual. Okay. With the suspense building, I need to get to the point right now. I need a little bit of indulgence with the court. As much as your question asked whether there were specific training requirements by the manufacturer, and I have said no, I'm not confident that you'll just take my word on it. So what I would like to do right now is resort to some legal devices, and the first one being mandatory judicial notice of law. So what I would ask the court to take mandatory judicial notice of, especially since it's not been contested that the manuals exist, they are in the possession of the prosecutor's office, they have been given in other cases in which the PDs have been involved, that's State versus Aquilano, and in the instant case also, and I'll get to your question, Justice Ginoza, about whether the specific manual was requested. And I know that in asking the court to take judicial notice, this is what it would be of this adjudicated fact, that the user's manual for the LTI 2020 laser speed gun that was used in this specific case contains no specific training requirements at all. I understand and accept my obligation in making this request that I need to provide you with the necessary information to show as an adjudicated fact it's capable of accurate and ready determination by resort to sources whose accuracy cannot reasonably be questioned. What I will ask, here is the information that supports my request for the adjudicated fact. I will provide the court, and I also have courtesy copies of everything that I'll give the court that I can give the defense counsel. I would only ask that with respect to the manual, it's not disseminated. Specifically, do I know why people have this belief that it has a copyright infringement? So, but it can be disseminated with court order to be used in a particular case like it was in this. So,
wait, before you go further, when you say like it was in this case,
right,
what do you mean by that?
I mean that jumping out of order is part of the information that will justify my request for judicial notice. If you look at the Jeff's docket of this, in this case, on page docket number 11, the record on appeal, at page 3, there's a specific motion to compel evidence for the laser speed gun used in this case. The only evidence is it was the ultralight laser 2020, which I have the manual that I'll give to this court, that was used in this case.
So what you referenced as docket 11 at page 3 is the request, the discovery request?
That's the quote, motion to compel discovery and the alternative, motion to dismiss for violation of Rule 16B and C of the Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure. I also have in the information that I need to justify my request, I have a copy of the relevant pages from that motion. Furthermore, then at the docket page, again, docket 11, the RA Record on Appeal, page 3, there's a notation for August 26, 2011. That's the oral quote, oral order granting the motion. Then if you look at the docket at page 3, again, on October 10, 2011, there was a hearing, ellipsis, court had already granted that defense may copy, not disseminate the manual. Defense was to prepare the protective order. Furthermore, docket at number 6, it's the transcript of August 26, 11, at pages 3, lines 2 through 18. The deputy prosecutor indicated that request in regards to the, quote, laser manual the deputy public defender confirmed, after which the court ordered, I'll grant it as to the manual, deny it as the other. Well, I don't know as far as the rest of the list that isn't provided as a matter of course. The court allowed the deputy public defender to copy it, and counsel confirmed that It's to use for this case, the public defender confirmed that it was to use for this case only, not for use in any other case for any other purpose. If you go to the docket 5, for whatever reason, things happen, and in October 10th, 2011, page 3, lines 10 through 15, this is the court. And during the interim, the clerk had checked on the status of the motion. Apparently, it was granted as to the manual and denied as to everything else, and there was supposed to be a protective order. Has either counsel any knowledge of what happened to the manual, or has it been reviewed or copied? The deputy public defender, Your Honor, to my knowledge, it has not been reviewed or copied. And then what they did is they asked for a continuance so that they can get the manual and, I guess, review it and copy it. Thereafter, the court says, Mr. Ramos, who is the public defender, they'll get the manual and prepare. You'll get the manual and prepare, and then you can decide if you want to go to trial or not, close quote. Also, with respect to the support...
So you think that record shows that, they, in fact, they received the manual before trial began?
Oh, yeah, I don't. And the concession today, it's pretty clear that he presumes they did. But with respect to the judicial notice that needs to be taken, I believe it shows there's no question that the manual does exist, that we have possession of it, that they can get it, just like they did in Apollino, where they set the specific manuals of which Judge Gonzalez has already referred to. And I believe further information that would support the notice of judicial request, I mean, that mandatory judicial notice be taken, is that the Hawaii Supreme Court itself has recognized implicitly the existence of the manual and it being in possession of my office, as well as the fact that the manual is an acceptable and reliable source for the requirements of LTI. Why do I say this? Look at State versus Gonzalez. They found with respect to the accurately working problem, they discussed the manual. And that was sufficient to meet that problem. What we fell down on is the operator's problem. Back to my other reasons why I believe the mandatory judicial notice should be taken. If you look through the manual, on the very first pages, it makes it abundantly clear that it's an LTI-produced publication. It has the LTI copyright. The manual contains the reference to the ultralight, which is the registered trademark of LTI. The manual bears the insignia of LTI, which is also registered, and can be found on the website that I will also give the copy of, which is their homepage. Moreover, on page 1 of the manual, so that there's no dispute that the manual actually comes with the device, it says, purchaser, when you get this device, what you should do, quote, when you receive your ultralight laser instrument, check to see that you have received everything you ordered. If you perceive any physical damage to the instrument or if any other order part is missing, contact the shipper. Basic ultralight package, user's manual.
All right, Mr. Fudo, let me say this. Okay, you're in effect before us now making a motion for us to take judicial notice of the manual.
Correct.
But we haven't done that yet.
I understand.
And it's very difficult for us in the midst of your oral argument to make a decision as to whether we should.
I understand.
So I think the more appropriate response would be either that you file a motion requesting us to take judicial notice to give the defense an opportunity to provide their position on that issue, and or file a motion to request that be made part of the record of the trial court, because you indicate that was something that could have been made a record at trial. And give the defense an opportunity to take a position on that. But for purposes of this argument, why don't we do this? Assuming you're right, that the training manual or the manual does not contain the manufacturer's recommendations, what's your argument as to whether a sufficient foundation has been made with respect to the qualification of the officer to use the device?
Can I address everything you just said? The reason I'm doing it as I propose is because precedent says I can. The recent case, which we've already discussed, State versus Davis, makes clear that judicial notice can be taken at any time, even for the first time on appeal. Particularly when I go before the Ninth Circuit, I just follow the rule, provide the information.
Right, but I'm telling you, for purposes of the argument, we're not, at this point, taking judicial notice of what you're telling us we should take judicial notice of.
Okay, and that's fair game. I just want to complete my record and say, finally, for the same guy, I was prepared to give that to the court also. So really, I'm just going by the rule of evidence, says that when the party requests mandatory judicial notice, and supplies the necessary information for the adjudicated fact. The case law, and this would be Metcalf, Supreme Court case came out last year, says the court must do it. But not wanting to antagonize the court, and also, again, in line with my responsibilities as a minister of justice, the manual has no training requirements, but I don't want to leave the court with the impression that there's no training at all, because that would be equally unfair and inconsistent with the position taken by LTI.
Well, before you go on to that, Mr. Fudo,
yes.
As a minister of justice, how do you explain the requirement under Gonzalez, Apollonio, Amaral, that the prosecution has the obligation at trial to establish the requirements indicated by the manufacturer? And so why does it matter whether we take judicial notice of the lack thereof of requirements in your, as you're asserting at this point in this case? How does that, why should that matter in this
it
case?
It matters because it underscores and it exposes that the court, the Supreme Court, is proceeding under an erroneous presumption, like Justice, like Judge Nakamura pointed out in Amaral, and the concurring dissent pointed out in Amaral, that these requirements exist.
The state
if they don't exist, the there's nothing to prove.
The state took 2 days to try to establish foundation in this case as to whether the officer's training was consistent with the manual. That was the ultimate evidence, finally, that was established at trial. The maximum evidence that was established at trial in this case. Wouldn't you agree?
Definitely, I agree.
So the state never, although it had possession of the manuals, whichever manuals we are talking about, you have two in front of us today, the state never admitted any manuals at trial in this case, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So I want the record to be clear on that as well.
And what I'm also saying is that I'm not aware of any law or precedent that says the state is required to prove a negative. And furthermore, I guess I'll apologize for what the state did with the preface that I'm not entirely certain, now having immersed myself in this issue, that all the prosecutors are aware of all of the information that I know, that they've read all the discovery that's put out, that they've read all the correspondence and information from Ultralight. Because if you're asking me now, not as the state, the amorphous state, but as an individual, if that objection came into me at trial, I would first ask the court to consider Rule 103 and it's a specific objection.
Be clear, what objection?
That the officer has not testified that his training met the specific requirements of LTI.
Okay.
And I would challenge the defendant to come forth with a good faith basis to first say that those exist. Because if no such requirement exists, then there's no requirement that we prove that. So what I want to make clear, though, is that these officers are trained pursuant to a comprehensive and rigorous training program of HPD that LTI has given its blessing in a certified letter in 2013, also which I wanted the court to take judicial notice of, but I understand the trepidation. It seems I would have to make a motion.
So your suggestion is that the burden of proof at trial should be initially on the defense to show that there is or is not a requirement of the manufacturer for training?
Absolutely not.
So explain what is your burden of proof that you are asserting to this court?
A, to prove the operator's prong, B, to prove the accuracy prong. But with respect to the operator's prong, it's a specious objection to say it can only be satisfied by meeting specific requirements by LTI, which do not exist.
Just to the manufacturer.
Exactly.
I understand.
In the future, do I hope deputies will understand that it's the HPD that has its training requirement that just has been given the blessing? I hope that. But it's not a perfect world. That's why I'm here.
All right. So putting all that aside, what evidence is there in this case to establish that this police officer was qualified by experience and training to operate the device? And assuming you can't prove the existence of something that doesn't exist in terms of the manufacturer's recommendation, you still have to lay the foundation that the officer was qualified to operate the device. What foundation was laid at trial to establish that fact?
As I said in my supplemental brief, I don't think there was enough foundation laid for that. I don't think that the deputies knew to explore that fact in detail. I think they've been misled or at least misunderstood the holding of this long list of cases that piggybacks on this notion that LTI has these specific requirements, and that's why they struggled for 2 days to try and lay foundation for something that doesn't exist. And I think it's exacerbated by Justice DeGanoza's point that the objections were ad nauseum. And it's the same thing. They keep saying that we haven't met the requirements of LTI. Well, that's where I'm hoping, again, that when I get back to my office, my deputies will see. Folks, there's no such requirement. And you can either ask that on the front end in one question to get it out of the way, and then put the defense on the spot. If I'm wrong, show us. I'm sure they'll show us if I'm wrong. But it has to seem a little bit curious to this court intuitively. Why is it that they compel the production of these manuals before trial and then don't use them at trial? Would that be because the training requirements are in the manual? Well, that would certainly help them. Or is that because that there's no training requirements in the manual? And I think it's, and I know it's the latter.
All right, so in this case, you're basically conceding error in terms of the fact that the court inappropriately found that they had laid a sufficient foundation for the operator qualification prong of the foundation for the laser gun. Therefore, the court erred in admitting the laser gun reading.
I'm comfortable with that saying, accepting that, yes.
Because the attempt was to try to prove that the training was in compliance with the manufacturer's recommendation, which doesn't exist, which is your assumption, but did not then also provide, because they were focused on that, did not provide other evidence that would be sufficient to show under general foundational requirements that this officer was qualified to operate the device.
Correct. They were so focused on that, they didn't ask clarifying questions to the officer. Well, in fact, have you been trained? Yes. Pursuant to what protocol? HVD. Could you please explain the extent of your training and not in generalities as to specifics?
Right. What did you do in your training to show that you were qualified to operate this device? Well, I aimed it at the car or I aimed it at something and I passed the test.
Correct. But unfortunately, that wasn't done.
Okay.
So I that's the most I can say with that. But I think the more germane question is, I don't know that any case locks in the requirement for this particular device as being the LTI's training. And in fact, I do know there's cases from the other jurisdictions, in fact, seminal cases that address this technology, and just that the officer has to be appropriately trained. If you want the site, I can give you the site.
Well, I think that's what Tylo says, right?
It says that, but when you ask the defense counsel, are there cases from other jurisdictions? Certainly there are. And what they want is the officer's training to come out in the evidence. What they don't say is they hook it on to LTI as the only one. If you go to the LTI website, which is common to anyone that has the internet, you also see that they have, as a support service for their device, just like computer programs do, they'll go around the country, and if you want to come to a training seminar, come. Some are open to the public, some are open to just the police enforcement agencies. But they make clear that these are not hard and fast. Depending on the level of competence of the particular officers, most specifically whether they've used their other products, predecessor products like the Marksman, you wouldn't need to have as much training as the person that's never held a speed gun in your hand. And as I thought I heard you intimate, this device, actually not rocket science. I'm not saying it's mindlessly simple, but what LTI makes clear in these manuals is if you get a speed reading, the device worked. Now whether the operator could correctly read it, i.e. a 98 mile per hour speed indication wasn't transposed to 89, or whether he said I shot the red Ford Mercury when in fact the defendant had a red Ford Taurus, that's the operator in the sense of recollection or recordation error, not the device. They are consistent in the cases are replete that when the device gets a speed reading, the device is working properly.
Do you have a comment on the jurisdictional question after Davis?
I think after Davis and before Davis, it was clear to me that it's not jurisdictional. What Justice Acoba did finally to me is a bailout in Davis, in his concurrence, he made it clear that if it was jurisdictional, the court's only authority is to decide whether jurisdiction exists. But what they're doing in Davis, obviously, is they're going forward and looking at the sufficiency of evidence. So he concluded clearly it's not jurisdiction. I've been in the district court initially when this Nesmith nightmare came out, arguing this is not jurisdictional. And if it's a due process, that's a constitutional error which has never been declared to be structural, such that a harmless error analysis doesn't apply. And I think it's quite specious, although I understand the precedent, what it says, that as a defense counsel, you can come to trial, having had motions to continue, motions to get information, come to trial and announce to the court, I'm ready to proceed, mount a defense, never mention anything about, oh, I don't know what I was doing because I didn't understand the charge. And then for the first time on appeal, or when not even asked, okay, yeah, due process.
But even if it's not jurisdictional, the Supreme Court says you can raise it at any time, right?
No, I understand what the Supreme Court says, and I respect what they say. But, you know, do I agree with it intellectually, analytically? I don't know how they reach that result. And I don't know if they've ever considered, well, if it's not jurisdictional and it's a constitutional error that's non-structural, why isn't it subject to the chamber's harmless error analysis? It certainly should be, or the court should accept it from it. But inasmuch as it's never been addressed, and parties in cases have continually asked, is it jurisdictional, is it not? They don't answer it.
Is that an open question now going forward after Davis?
Well, the majority didn't address that. Justice Acoba, the retired Justice Acoba, addressed that in his part of the opinion. So it's not really controlling. But I think it raises an interesting question now when an objection as to jurisdiction is interposed. So in the right case, would I challenge it? Certainly. Is this the right case with all that went wrong? Certainly not. And that's why I started out and in my supplemental. I don't want to waste the court's time and make it seem as if this conviction should be affirmed. Too much went wrong. But I'm not willing to concede it was strategy or any kind of knowing choices. I just believe people have a bad day and cases have a bad history. And this, unfortunately, is a constellation of both. So,
Mr. Fudo, I have a question. You've spoken about other cases and how they've been handled, and you certainly have a point of view that maybe a lot of the other deputies in your office don't have. You've seen a lot of these cases. Have you ever seen a case where somebody from LTI or a representative or an alleged agent of LTI has in any way by affidavit, by as a witness, or in any other way tried to be presented at trial?
Absolutely, yes. In the seminal case that came out of New Jersey to establish the technology for the laser speed readings, that's what was done.
But in Hawaii, has your office ever attempted to do that?
As far as I know, no. No, not with respect to the laser speed gun. We went through this with the calibration for the dynamometer and speed cases where we put individuals on to make clear that, again, the device was not rocket science. And what the case also made clear is that you didn't need a specific manufacturer specification for parts of this instrument because it wasn't necessary. Just as long as a mechanic with basic mechanical competence knew how to run the device and did so properly, the device would give an accurate reading. If it doesn't give a reading, it's because it's broke, just like this. And in this case, now that I recall too, the information from LTI makes clear, if you get the error message, there's two different types of error message, which are basically what I call fatal. Send the device back. But beyond that, the literature from LTI makes clear that their product needs no calibration, contrary to what Justice Acoba felt was the case, based upon an errant answer taken out of context in an oral argument. And they make also equally clear that there's no regularly scheduled maintenance to this. It's what I would call regular prudent handling, i.e. they're saying, don't drop it. Don't operate it beyond a certain temperature. If there's a smudge on the lens of the scope, clean it off.
Thank you.
All right, I think your time's up.
Thank you, Mr. Fudo.
Mr. Fudo's concession on the issues of this case. I I kind of take offense to his implications in some senses that, you know, the Nesbitt issue could be withheld as a kind of, you know, appeal by ambush type of thing, or that, you know, there's other, that we're in bad faith asking questions about the training requirements that in fact do not exist. You know, one, Mr. Fudo had ample time to provide this information to me that he intended to try and introduce these manuals. He did not do so. We did supplemental briefs. He did supplemental authorities. He did not do so. I believe that it's deceptive in this case to just give the operator's manual when, in fact, all the cases reference four manuals. HPD, the officers, the state, the deputy prosecutors all ask questions about the training. If it would be that simple for them to just say, there are no training requirements in these manuals, they never do. So it appears that there are training requirements. Now, there's some question. Now, Mr. Food is providing the operator's manual. He's not providing the training manuals. The training manuals, as we referenced in other cases, have an HPD seal, but also have an LTI copyright, which implies that they are sanctioned by LTI. There are specific training requirements in those manuals. So if LTI, if the state is trying to establish that LTI sanctions these so that we can use them in terms of learning to do the tests,
But is the requirement that the training be in compliance with the manufacturer's recommendation, why is that an element of the foundation? I mean, if a smart manufacturer got a hold of that, why don't they say, you got to send your officers to a 3-week training course and pay us $1,000 a week to satisfy the training requirement? I mean, why is the focus on the manufacturer's recommendation? Why is that a crucial element of laying the foundation?
I believe because in this case, I mean, it's a reading that's going to be used in court for proof beyond a reasonable doubt of a conviction of a defendant who's subject to certain penalties. So there has to be some, you know, specific basis. The fact that there are these manufacturer's recommendations, and the state has never, in any case up till now, disputed that these recommendations exist. In the numerous cases that were in district court and the numerous appeals that have come forth, they've never taken this position that there are no such requirements. You know, it appears that, again, based on the state's own questions, that there are requirements. Otherwise, the state, perhaps, is being a little bit disingenuous or deceptive by asking questions in its initial foundation as to whether the training meets these requirements. I know the court is trying to get to the bottom of this whole thing, but what my position is that on the record before this court, the manual was not entered into evidence. Subsequently, there were more manuals that were mentioned in Amaral, those in subsequent cases. So for Mr. Fudo to just provide the one manual which he claims was provided in this case, you know, would not adequately address the concerns raised in the subsequent cases in which four manuals were provided. Again, the state had ample opportunity to enter these manuals into evidence, to seek to have LTI personnel come via affidavit, letter, testimony, whatever it was, to try and authenticate, or just come down and say, hey, we have no specific training requirements. We have no recommendations. All we know is that if you follow our manual, you're okay to use it. But the state, time after time again, in all these cases, in appeals, in trial cases, has asked what the training requirements were, whether they were certified or qualified. So if there's any impropriety here, then it's in the state's questioning and trying to deceive the court that there are such requirements, because the court is only acting based on what the record is before it. And if the state is not going to dispute that such requirements exist, or is going to continue to ask questions that imply that such requirements exist, and the state is going to fail to enter the manual into evidence, or have an LTI representative come, or even have the officer just say, you know, hey, there's no requirements, I didn't see anything in the manual. But the state, in these cases, seeks to prove that LTI sanctions even the training manuals by adducing evidence that the copyright is on it. So for Mr. Fudo to come up now and to say that there are no such requirements is completely inconsistent with the position his office has taken since Asaya. And again, I thank the court for not taking judicial notice immediately of the manual. I would, you know, just ask that in the future, if the state is going to try this type of appeal by ambush or surprise, that they at least observe some of the decorum, you know, that's observed by these courts. You know, we had spoken about this beforehand. We had also done briefing on it. And Mr. Fudo never mentioned the possibility of seeking to adduce anything or ask the court to take judicial notice of this. So my only supposition is that, you know, he was either playing hide the ball or he just wanted to, you know, the dramatic effect of doing so. But again, if the court, if he's going to seek to do it by motion, we'd ask for an opportunity to respond and object to that motion as well.
All right.
What is the disposition ultimately that I mean, we talk about this and the state has essentially said if there is no foundation.
If in this case, because there's no foundation for the speed reading, there would be no sufficient evidence of the defendant's speed to sustain his conviction. So given even the Nesmith issue existing, Davis makes it clear that you would still have to rule on the sufficiency. So what we're asking for is reversal of the conviction.
So a combination of Davis and ultimately the disposition in Asai.
Correct. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we'll take this case under advisement. But Mr. Fudo, we'll give you 3 weeks to file any motions you're going to file. Otherwise, you're at risk of the court rendering a decision without your motions.
Thank you.
Right? Thank you.